Hello and welcome to episode 152 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Valentine, and Chris Weston. It's a Monday evening, where we are. Where it is you are, I don't know, because that's the magic of the podcast. It's basically a time machine of audio format. And it's just you and me tonight, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. If it's a time machine in audio format, can we go back for about, I don't know, 10 years? Because everything seemed a lot calmer then.
Yeah. That would be nice, wouldn't it? This is the year that keeps on giving, isn't it? It's wow. There was a thing somebody posted on Twitter this morning. There's a search thing. It's just using the advanced search in Twitter, but it gives you your Twitter timeline from 10 years ago. Not quite in order, but it's fascinating to go back 10 years and to, you know, the early days of the coalition government.
Oh God.
I know, it's just, and then you, yeah, it's your, you know, the people you follow at the moment, but 10 years ago, most of them aren't on Twitter. That's a really interesting thing as well. How has your week been? What have you been up to?
Well, it's been, very much like everybody, I suppose, another week, rather like the one before, in as much as I haven't been anywhere, but I have been doing more stuff around podcasting and doing a little bit of trials of some things that we might do at work, and some video stuff, and some online event stuff, and working with my customers, which is nice. So we have, you know, it's been another one of those weeks, really. I think from a kind of 2020 point of view, and talking about what was on the Twitters this morning, I saw a story which I thought was good about the fact that Chinese have kind of deployed an army of ducks to go to somewhere like Thailand and eat locusts.
That's perfect, isn't it?
Yeah. So that's, you know, along with the murder hornets, we've got locust-eating duck swarms. It's turning into that type of year, isn't it? You really couldn't invent it.
No. If I were religious, I'd start to believe something were afoot, but I'm not, so I don't. But yeah, it's. I can't believe you're considering doing other podcasts. I feel used.
Imagine, Matt. Imagine how that must be to have your podcast chum go off and do another one. I mean, you wouldn't do that, would you?
No. Certainly not for money. I wouldn't. No, I'd just do it for the love of it.
Well, I can assure you that this will be a. An occasional thing, I think, rather than a regular thing. You know, we haven't got as much time really in the week to do that sort of thing. And I'd be surprised if we do more than one a month. But it's just looking at the format really, and the fact that everybody seems to be finding different ways to fill their time because, you know, we're all in lockdown, or at least we're working from home. And I saw something the other day about. Who was it? There was somebody in the ecosystem who I think I've got a lot of time for, otherwise I wouldn't have read it, but I can't remember who it was. But they were talking about the fact that everybody's on Zoom meetings all the time, Zoom is becoming a word like Hoover, isn't it? Skype used to be Skype, now it's Zoom.
Which must be particularly galling for Microsoft, seeing as they bought Skype, destroyed it as a verb, and now Zoom has taken over instead of Teams.
Yes, that's what you have to do. That's what happens when you buy a horrible, crap piece of software. but yeah, they said because everybody's on the video calls all the time, they want to put something in place to give people a bit of a break, and so they've. Organised times when they have walking meetings, so they are definitely audio only, and it's just like a phone call that you can. But it's like we're going to do this, and we'll go for a walk individually, of course. And I think that's quite a nice idea because it gives you an excuse to get out of the house, which is something you really need, or even sometimes a imperative to get out of the house. Because when you're either going to be on a lot of calls and then have work to do, or whatever, it's quite easy to sit in your little office from, or at your kitchen table or wherever it is, from, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock in the evening, and not hardly move, which is very good for us as middle-aged men with middle-aged spread, Mr. Valentine. How about yourself?
Apart from my middle-aged spread, I've got a squeaky chair now, which is
oh good. Well,
hugely,
I'm
hugely
I'm
amusing.
I'm going to moan about it now.
Exactly. You're not the one who has to edit out all the squeaks. So my week has been, yeah, pretty much more of the same, really. Just trying to be able to plot a course for both bringing some new people into the organisation and the longer-term strategy plus kind of short-term operational things. Yeah, interspersing that with trying to make sure that the kids don't completely lose the plot. So, you know, as is.
Children losing
plot. Continues. Yeah, exactly. But I think that, yeah, the idea of being able to break up the meeting routine. We've been doing quite a lot of research with our staff over the last few weeks, and we found that most people do definitely seem to want to be able to continue to work remotely as a standing thing beyond this. But there is this kind of desire to want to be able to meet with others in person. And I think we'll talk about this a bit later in the show, but that this is a real problem, I think, that organisations have got to face, because that desire to be able to meet in person is the thing that is going to be least likely to happen for quite a period of time, unless you're an MP, of course, in which case you just throw all caution to the wind and stand in 45-minute queues. So, yeah, trying to be able to think about how we are able to address some of that and be able to... I think the thing is about just being able to see how we can start to take advantage of the fact that we are working remotely, and whether that's by being able to work with people that we wouldn't have been able to if we were all in the same physical place, or whether it's through new means or being able to enable people to have more flexibility than they would have before because they don't have to travel, a bunch of things like that. I think it's starting to get into some of that stuff that will be of benefit for both the individual and the organisation. So that's where the thinking is at the moment.
I guess, you know, even this podcast, these tools aren't that new. When we first started this, I think we did the first one on Hangouts, maybe?
Zoom.
Yeah. And it wouldn't have been possible to do something like this and do a kind of collaborative effort spread over, you know, many miles without video conferencing. So these tools aren't new, and I suppose that point you made about I'd love somebody to tell me what I haven't really been following the political shenanigans, right, because there's just life's too short for listening to what Jacob Rees-Mogg says, but I just don't understand. I haven't been able to figure out what, just turn the cynical button off for the moment, Matt, and turn the, you know, just try and forget all of what you know about this.
Are you about to ask me to get into the mind of Jacob Rees-Mogg?
No, I'm not going to ask you to do that, because that would be cruel. I want to know what the real, genuine reason, not you know, the horrible Machiavellian reason that we all think, or whatever it might be. I really want to know why they decided that it would be a good idea to take, you know, hour and a half or whatever it is over these votes, and make people queue, you know, all around the Westminster Estate in order to vote, when they had an electronic voting system which was working perfectly reasonably well. Given that, you know, most of the world is heading towards the digitisation of process, why did they stop it?
I think, I mean, the slightly Machiavellian reason, which was that because Johnson is performing so badly in Prime Minister's Question Time, so they need an audience around him, is obviously... No, but that's refuted by the fact... But it's not, because it was... the House is still limited to 50 MPs in it at any time, so there's not going to be an audience there, whatever.
Yeah, okay.
There's one that they talk about, which is that they were worried about the fact that they've got a legislative backlog, and therefore they needed to make sure that they could get the votes through. But these votes take longer than the electronic
ones. It takes forever to get them done.
There was one about how MPs need to be able to... I think the Rees-Mogg version is that MPs need to be able to take a long, hard, serious think about voting for things, and that's not possible to do when you're sitting around in your pants on a Zoom call.
Well,
maybe there's something in that. But
is it? Is it? We all have to do long, hard, serious thinking at work, or at least some of us do. And we really do they have to be sitting on wooden pews in the Commons,
queuing up around the? Who knows?
Don't think for a minute of what they vote. Do they just vote as they're told to?
Well, yeah. There were some conversations about, there was a worry about that the votes could be placed fraudulently. Or a young child might amble into the room and press the wrong button at the wrong time. That one's definitely been seriously discussed. I know. Or, which is probably my most... I just think absolutely nobody has the first idea what they're doing anymore.
Well, that might be... That might be a reason in terms of it might be a contributory factor, but it isn't a reason, you know. It isn't a thing that's, you think, oh, let's do this because we don't know what we're doing.
Oh, no, that's not because. But any of the reasons that are given are absolutely nonsensical, but in the same way that driving 30 miles to be able to test your eyesight is absolutely nonsensical.
Well, again, and now you're sort of dipping into cynicism, which I'm trying to avoid. There must be a reason, and I'm just... I'm agog at the fact that they've decided to do this when they've got a perfectly acceptable... And also, you know, you've got the side effects that mean that vulnerable people are shielding that can't go in the commons because, you know, they're all that kind of thing. Why? I do not understand it. And I'm turning off all of the cynicism to say just a reason, a sensible, valid reason. And I saw opinion polls that say that most public think that they should be able to vote electronically because, of course, they don't want them standing around looking at their phones or making, you know, sardonic videos about the fact that they're how ridiculous it is that then they all trooped in to vote for not having the electronic votes anyway, or at least the Conservative lot did. What is going on? I don't understand it. And I tend to understand these things, but I've stopped watching it for a while, and now I don't know. Everything's changing. I don't know what's going on or what day it is.
I think all I can conclude with it all is that it's basically, as the Osmonds said in the early 1970s, there must be a reason. Let the reason be love.
Right, okay, Matt, that'll do. I'm happy with that.
Excellent. Right, let's press on with the show. Tonight we are going to be doing a bit of a public service announcement. We've got a bit of a quiz and we're going to talk about events in a digital realm, which is a sort of update of a conversation we had a few months back, but we've got a bit more intel and gossip on it now. So shall we press on? There's been a lot of events going on in the last few weeks, and sort of geopolitical stuff, and we had a bit of a debate before we started recording tonight about whether we should talk about the issues of race and systemic challenges about race in the UK, because there's two white, middle-aged, middle-class, straight men. There's probably not much more that we could say to be able to be a definition of privilege. But I think it is just basically to say, I think there is a need for people like us to be able to try to work out what it is that we should be doing. And I'm not entirely sure what that is, but probably starts with trying to be able to just find out more about stuff and read more about stuff and listen to stuff and be able to try to be able to start from a position of thinking about how we can start to contribute to be able to address some of the obvious issues that exist.
Indeed. Indeed. And I think... As you say, it's quite difficult. And I think our guest on a podcast a few weeks ago, Shireen Daniels, there was one video that she did recently because she's been talking quite a lot about this recently. And she talked about the fact that people don't know what to say sometimes, and maybe they don't want to say anything for saying the wrong thing. And actually, you know, I haven't watched everything that Shireen's put out recently because she's put out quite a lot of stuff. But everything that I have seen is very thoughtful and instructive. And I think there is certainly a reticence to get it wrong. And I think as somebody who has a lot to say on most things, I have opinions about things. But also, one knows that sometimes one's opinion isn't welcome or indeed necessary. And on this subject, as with other subjects, it's like J.K. Rowling, for example, and the last couple of days she said something wrong in it that's upset some people about transgender or honestly I know so little about that area other than, you know, the basics. I don't know whether somebody's got a right to be upset or not got a right to be upset, but I think it's really important that, I guess, as people who... Oh, you're like yourself, for example, Matt. You're in a position of responsibility with a job, with a management job in a company that provides, you know, services to lots of different people. And I've been in similar positions. And I think when you're in those positions, it's important, I think, just to listen to what people have to say, because we can all form our opinions and we can all have our hot takes on things, but it's sometimes it's not whether what you think is right or wrong, and sometimes it's not about being right, because, you know, God knows I know that it's not all about being right all the time, otherwise I'd be a wealthy man. It's also about bringing everybody along with you, and therefore I think from my point of view it's just about listening, just try to be as open as possible, understand what people are saying. Often people are describing experiences that I haven't had and can't have because I don't come from that background and haven't had those, you know, those experiences. But that best thing we can do is just be there to listen and support where we can, really. And sometimes you have to ask what that support has to look like rather than making your own mind up.
Absolutely. We'll put a few links that might be helpful if you want to be able to explore some stuff yourself. Shireen, as you say, Chris, has been putting out some really thought-provoking stuff on LinkedIn. Somebody else who I have met once and follow on Twitter and occasionally converse with is John Amici, who is a professor of psychology. He is based up from Manchester. He was the first British MBA star in the US. He went out as a kid to go to university and then became a professional basketball player. He has got a fantastic insight into a whole bunch of different things for both the UK and the US, having experienced both cultures. And he's just got such a beautifully calm approach to talking about some of these sometimes quite challenging issues. And he's been on TV a fair bit recently as well. So, but there's a couple of videos he's put out. And he did an interview on LBC that's well worth a listen as well. And if you've got other things that you think are worth sharing around this, let us know and we'll stick them onto the web page and build up a little library so people can start to be able to work out how they can listen more.
Okay, well, Matt, I hear from you on the WB40 grapevine, which is essentially the bits between this when we talk about what we're going to do, that you have a quiz for me, which I find thrilling and exciting as you lure me into a grisly end. What is it?
Yeah. Well, so I can't remember. There's some TV series that I don't know what it is, where basically it's a really quick way to be able to do quizzes, because all you need to do is find a list of stuff and then you basically, I mean, it works better with multiple groups, but for this I'll give the top 10
if you like.
Yeah, you can be, no, don't do that, that'd be far too confusing. The top 10 software companies, largest software companies in the world by market capitalization.
What now?
How far down the list can you get?
What,
top
what
10
now?
Right now,
as in today,
as in, well, financial year 2019, so for their last reported.
Well, aren't we all software companies now, Matt? You know, aren't we?
No, we're not.
No. So these are companies that make their living selling software.
Yeah, they're not conventional IT. They're not conventional internet companies. Yeah, so Microsoft is one of your 10. Well done.
Okay, all right. Well, no, I'm just saying that they sell software, but you know, you could look at Amazon, for example. Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon.
They're a massive software provider. They sell software as a service solutions to merchants and stores, but they're not in there.
So, but according to the Forbes list.
Okay. Well, I know what Forbes are like in terms of their. We'll take anybody. So, okay. Well,
software and programming.
Salesforce.
Number five.
Number five.
Yeah.
Mama. Okay, so if it's not Salesforce, Oracle.
Salesforce. Oracle is number two.
SAP.
Number three.
Wow.
So now it gets challenging,
quite frankly. It does, because I'm in this game, right? So I should know this. This is an IDC. There's probably the IDC list behind all of it. I'm going to get blackballed from the IDC club.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Remember, by market capitalization.
Oh, right. Oh, really? Okay. I see. Well, but they sell software.
But they
not
sell
stuff
software.
With software in them.
No.
So
they're all companies that traditionally you would have thought of, you know, in the days of shrink wrapped software, they would have produced shrink wrapped.
Even though
Google are not there, no. So you've got Microsoft, Oracle, SAP, and Salesforce.
Are there any security vendors in there?
No.
Okay. Are Zoom in there?
No. Oh, they've got their sales. So the smallest sales of any of these companies is $2.6 billion.
I'm trying to think of something that governments use and pay through the nose for. No.
And IBM aren't in the list.
No.
And none of those integrators are.
So is it somebody? Is it going to be something weird that people who make mobile apps or something?
No.
Software companies, you say?
Software companies. You've got four out of the top 10.
I don't think I'm going to get this, Matt.
Do you want some clues?
Yeah, give me some clues.
Okay, the first one is that think creative software.
Adobe.
Fourth. Adobe is worth more in 2019 on its market capitalization than Salesforce.
Wow.
But Adobe these days increasingly is a marketing platform vendor thing, so that's probably why. Only got $9.5 billion in sales, though. It's the lowest of the top 10. Salesforce has $13.3 billion. Sorry, so the lowest of the top five. Okay, so next clue, virtualization.
Oh, okay. So those guys with the virtualization stuff.
Yes.
You know who I'm talking about.
I do know because I'm reading it on the screen at the moment. I can see exactly who it is.
Hypervisor people.
Think so, yeah.
The, I don't know. V something.
Yeah. Yeah. Them.
Yeah. Those guys.
VMware.
That's it. Yeah. VMware. Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. The next one, I couldn't tell you what they make, to be honest.
Well, it's not Micro Focus, is it? It's not somebody with.
No. Number seven is Intuit.
Intuit. That was database software, I think.
Possibly. They're 66.8
finance, maybe finance.
$1 billion of. Oh, do they make tax software and stuff?
Yeah, I think they do finance stuff.
That'd be it. Number eight, if you want to run on help desk, you will run it on this these days.
Oh, of course, yeah, ServiceNow.
Yeah, that's eighth.
They've done very well recently, haven't they?
An HR systems provider, number nine.
HR.
That's what they're known for. They'd rather be known as a much more full service organisation, but as it was.
No, don't know. You have to tell me.
It's Workday.
Oh, of course, yeah. Okay.
And then you've already had the one German company. There's one other European company in the top 10. And I don't believe that you've got a chance in hell of getting this right. It's quite a surprise.
Well, it's not Autonomy, is it? Because they're part of HP now and probably worth tuppence, ain't they? And they're not British then. It's not Cambridge Analytica.
No, it's certainly not. No.
And then, are they German?
Nope.
Oh.
I tell you what, I'm just looking at their website now and I've never heard of a single one of their products.
Oh, that's good, isn't it?
But they're the 10th biggest software company in 2019 by market capitalization.
No, go on, tell me who it is.
It's a company called Dassault Systems. And they do a whole bunch of software around 3D modelling.
Okay.
And they're the 10th biggest software company by market cap last year.
It's probably in a load of stuff, isn't it? And that's probably, it's a bit like VMware, isn't it? I mean, I should have really thought of VMware. But again, I don't think of VMware as a software company, really, even though they do sell software. But they kind of sell, it's the jam in the sandwich, isn't it, they're selling.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hidden away. It's a bit like the open source stuff. It's like the open stuff that we were talking about last week. All that stuff like Apache and WordPress and all this open stuff. I mean, if you looked at open source as a share with market share, it would be enormous, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. Actually, looking at Dassault, they also do some product lifecycle management software, so maybe that's where their market cap. But they're the eighth biggest on that list by sales. Where are they from?
Yeah, what country are they from?
France. They're based in Villers-Villacoublay. And they've been around since 1981.
Well,
just every so often you find something, you think you know an industry, and then you do something like that and you realise you know nothing.
Yeah, that's true. I wonder if, I'm sure I've got colleagues who would have aced that from top to bottom.
Well, there we go. Anyway, it's good to have a quiz every so often.
It is. Well, thank you for that, Matt. Thank you for luring me down that minefield. And I'm very glad I remembered who VMware are.
That's good. A topic that we've touched on a few times over the years is that of events. and particularly the tech industry, what they're for and why they couldn't be a bit better. And of course, in this current climate with social distancing and travel restrictions and what have you, we're in a position where people who are in the events industry are having to think quite hard about what they are going to do, because you can't organise events in the traditional way at the moment, and you probably won't be able to for quite some time to come. And, well, you're in that game now, aren't you, Mr. Weston?
Well, I am, or at least my employer is. And whilst I'm not directly involved in the events, I am indirectly, because I tend to support them and go to them and meet people there or speak or whatever. And there is certainly a big issue, right, in terms of how do you continue to have events when you're not allowed to get people together, and how will that happen when people can get together but you need to have much stricter controls about how people interact. And I guess even if you didn't, you know, even if there were no rules anymore, or if there are, you know, lockdown rules or restrictions or regulations, people would be much less inclined to go to events if they thought they were going to be trapped in a room with lots of people breathing on them, or, you know, lots of shared surfaces or buffets and all that kind of thing. So there is definitely an impact on the events world.
I've just realised that we have seen the end of the conference buffet, haven't we? That's the best news I've heard all week.
Definitely. I think the idea that you're going to be contemplating a rather tired-looking pastry that several people might have picked up and put down before are definitely over. But, and we've seen there was some movement on LinkedIn the end of last week where one or two of the events team at Gartner were saying that they're now redundant, and you know, there's a company who has made a lot of money out of events over the years, so you can understand why organisations are reluctant to spend the kind of money on events that they used to say. You know, I'm not going to talk about these companies too much, but if you look at Gartner Symposium, for example, which is probably the biggest European event for IT leaders in terms of numbers, I guess they could rake in a fair amount of revenue for vendors and different salespeople to go and stand there and be involved in that. Well, you're not going to get the same revenues from a virtual event, clearly. Now, the costs are fewer in terms of it costs much less to stage a virtual event, but what are you getting out of it as a vendor? What are you getting out of it as a sponsor? It's not going to be the same at all. So I can understand why organisations might think, well, we're going to stop doing this and let's look at it again in 12 months and see what it looks like. Or I can understand companies thinking, well, actually, we're going to do this completely differently. We're going to completely embrace the digital world, and we're going to find a way of making this work in an online way. But I think a lot of this is going to be down to actually, what do we want as individuals going to these events, right? Because at the end of the day, if you're a managing director or a marketing manager or a IT director or whatever you might be, who's being lured to a conference or a exhibition or whatever, at the end of the day, you're the product, right, aren't you? Because you're the thing that the company is selling to their sponsors. If you weren't there, the sponsors wouldn't be interested. So there's got to be a quid pro quo, and you've got to get something out of it when you go. And, you know, you and I have been to probably more of these than we should have been over the years, and probably certainly we've been to ones that we regret having gone to. And I always took the view that you had to kiss a few frogs, and in this kind of business you have to go to one or two crap ones, because actually when you go to the really good ones, they're really worthwhile, but you don't really know what they're going to be like, you know, until you get there. There's not really that much way of knowing. So you look forward to those ones where you come away having met some really interesting people, heard some really engaging speakers, learned some things you can take away, made some good connections, or you know, made a few friendships and all of that kind of thing, because they are fantastic and really worth the ones you go to and end up standing at the back drinking lukewarm coffee and wishing that you hadn't bothered making the journey. So the question is, what do we want from these things in future, and how will we get it in that sense? And we were talking about it on the group, weren't we? We had a bit of a chat in the WhatsApp group this week. And one of the things that really struck me was the idea that events are about almost about discipline as much as anything else. Once you commit to having that day out, that's your focus is on that. And that's another reason why it can be so disappointing when it's rubbish, because you've kind of invested that day. But having invested the day, once you get there, you make the best of it. If you've got any sense about you, you talk to people and you learn as much as you can. You sit and you take stuff in because you've got that time to yourself, and you've put your out of office on, and you've told people you're not going to be available. And if you've got any sense, you put your phone on silent and you're not going to be listening to your phone ring. So that sense of being out is something I think we'll miss, and I wonder how we're going to do, how we replicate that or whatever. What do you think?
I mean, that bit particularly is really interesting, and some of the comments in the group about that actually without actually taking yourself away to a conference venue, your ability to be able to maintain, and I found this with online events that I have been registered for, keeping your diary clear for an online event is way harder, and keeping your diary for an online event when you yourself are at home rather than the office is harder still. And that idea that there's an event, you know, it's an event, you know, the whole thing about it being an event, it's not just a meeting, it's an event, it's something that you will reserve that time for. And I think that is probably, for event organisers, going to be one of the biggest headaches they're going to face in a virtual world, is that it's so easy just to not bother or not. I mean, the turn up rates, particularly for events that don't have a fee associated with them, the people who actually turn up, 30%, 50% maybe, depending on the event, half the people. I mean, you factor that in when you're doing your registrations and whatever, you make sure that there's a lot of overbooking, because you know that a lot of people won't turn up. But the amount of overbooking you need to do for an online event is you know, perceptions of value and how, a whole bunch of things like that. I think the interesting bit for me is to start, though, is about who, if you think about the value chain or the value proposition for an event, and you've got the attendees, you've got the organiser, you've got probably people who are speaking. The fact that in IT events, it was something I found when I was working doing the stamp stuff, was that I would get contacted about appearing at an event to speak. And the first thing I would usually have to do is to qualify whether it was one of three potential options. Option one was that I'd be doing it for my profile, i.e. I wouldn't get paid for it. I wouldn't even get expenses for it most of the time. And so there'd had to be a really compelling reason for me to want to be able to do one of those. Option two would be that I would be being paid. Those didn't happen very often, but would often be quite lucrative if it were the case. And then the third option is that I would be expected to pay. So you get into this remarkable situation where different events had one of three value propositions. If you think about, say, the CIO events, some of the speakers at the CIO events have been paid to be there because they are the sponsors paying to book some time to actually present at the events. And the quality of those was very variable. So, for you know, there's so many different value approaches, value propositions for how events in that sort of sense work. And then how does an event organizer make money out of it? And what is there? Is it through the sponsorship? Is it through ticket price? Is it through after stuff? And actually, if you think about, then you look at the IT event, you've got everything from free to attend ones, you've all the way up to the Gartner Symposium ones. Is the value proposition to the attendee the same on all of those? But probably wasn't a lot of difference whether I was going for free or whether I was having to pay $5,000 to go there. It was about networking, it was about some content, it was about various other bits and bobs. In the same way that there's not really much difference in terms of functional value from a smart car to a Rolls Royce. But then there's another element of it, which is I'm also buying prestige. And there was definitely that about Gartner. So there's so many dimensions of this to then say, okay, we'll just make it digital. I don't think, unless people have actually sat back and gone, well, what are the value propositions for the people that we used to have as our customers, attendees, and how can we start to recreate those value propositions in new digital channels? Until you go through that exercise, what we'll end up with is basically pastiche events that are lots of people talking and maybe breakout rooms to be a little bit like the coffee area, and a crap load of people not bothering turning up.
Yeah, well, and maybe that's a sustainable model, in as much as long as you do get some people, you are going to fulfil the expectations of the people who are paying for it. And as you say, that's the end of the day, that you're there, an event's there to create an audience or gather an audience for some reason. And once that audience is there, then it's worth doing for somebody. And as I say, in order to go as the audience, sometimes people will pay, right? Okay, there are some events where you have to pay a ticket to go in, and some people will think that's worthwhile. Like the what's the event that Julia Hobsbawm does?
Names Not Numbers.
Names Not Numbers. You know, there's a fee to go to that, and people will either think it's worthwhile or they won't. But they're pretty well attended, and they're generally, the one I went to was very very interesting. So, but then they'll do that often because they don't want a sponsor. They don't want to have an angle. You know, they don't want to be seen to be have an agenda that's not specifically for the people attending. It's genuinely about those people. So there are different models, but I wonder. You know, I'm really interested in what people will get out of it and what they will miss, or how you can replicate those things. Because I've seen examples of the kind of virtual event. So rather than just turning up and ended up on what is essentially a Zoom or video call with bits of bells and whistles, as you say, breakouts and things like that, you got a virtual kind of virtual lobby and a little, you know, a thing to click on that's the main conference hall, and the thing to click on is where the exhibitions are, and it's a bit like being at an event if you were in Second Life or The Sims or something, which I can see the attraction of that, because when you go to an event, once you've been to a few, right, you kind of know how it goes, right? You know you're going to find somewhere to park or turn up on the train or whatever. You're going to go in, you're going to find somewhere, there's going to be a big table probably with a whole bunch of badges, and you're going to be given a badge, and you're going to be ticked off the list of people who have actually turned up, and you're going to be given a bunch of pamphlets or something telling you what's happening that day, and you're going to be pointed to where the coffee is and the stale pastries, and that's where you're going to start, and then you're going to get a chance to talk to people, because you know that's what's going to happen. As long as you're there on time, there are going to be people also getting coffee, and you're going to pick the person that looks least boring or mad, and you're going to have a conversation and hope that they're not utterly tedious, or from one of the vendor companies, right? So that's what you're going to do. And then there's going to be a thing, and you're all going to go in there, and you're going to be ready because you're going to get your coffee. You might be able to get a bottle of water. You're probably going to try and carry also a plate of the lovely breakfast things in there, so that at least, even if it is really boring, you can still have a drink and eat your stuff. And you're going to listen for a bit. And then you'll probably check your emails while you're listening to that. And then you're going to have something else. And you kind of know. You understand what that is. You understand what the expectations are of you. You understand what people are going to do. It's a familiar and well-worn path. There are norms. There's a kind of a cultural safety about those events, because you know what's going to happen, whether you love them or hate them. It's not the same now, is it? People don't really know what to expect when they come to these kind of random virtual events. Will I have my video on? Will I not have my video on? Will I get to talk? Will I be on the chat? Will I get to meet anybody else? Maybe I want to, maybe I don't want to. It's very, it's because it's very new and we're all trying to dig our feet in the water. There's just no expectation of what's going to happen.
And those norms, and then being able to work that out and being able to see that it looks like the event but isn't. There's a mate of mine who's been doing some market research with TV companies at the moment about what they should do when the Premier League comes back, and trying to be able to understand in focus groups what might work and what might not work. And they've done some experiments with chat rooms of fans from each club, so you can choose to have the group of people who are talking about the game who are fans. They've decided that's not going to fly, because basically Ofcom will shut them down with the amount of swearing that goes on.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
I can.
The last thing, when you go to a football game, if you're a season ticket holder, right, you're sitting in the same place, and if you're lucky, right, the people who are sitting around you are okay, right? I've never held a season ticket, or very rarely. And you go in, and sometimes, most of the time actually, the bloke standing two people away from you talking absolute just rot is the word I'm going to use politely. And you wish he would shut up, right? And he's one of your supporters on your side.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But what these kind of things, the more and more that I look at this stuff, starting with the idea of the event and then how do you make it into a digital thing is one approach. The other way, I think, is actually thinking about, well, what exists at the moment in digital realms that's sort of equivalent to an event, and how can we make it more event-like? And the more I think about that, the more that I think that platforms like Twitter could well be the starting point for this. Because actually the way that Twitter works, you get events happening on Twitter, you get the random conversations between strangers, you get friends meeting up, you get all of that dynamic, but in a very thin medium in comparison to being in the physical world. But nonetheless, it still has, it has depth to it and it has meaning to it. And I've got to know loads of people through Twitter and then got to meet them in physical world afterwards and whatever. The gap there, and it's a really interesting challenge, I think, for the tech industry, is that then becomes a test of, for the sorts of people who go to events, how social tools savvy are they? Because for those who are socially savvy about this stuff, we're on there already and we're doing it already. And actually those people, events organisers are going to struggle to be able to track, because they'll just look at it and go, yeah, but I can get that from Twitter, or I can get it from, well, probably can't get it from LinkedIn groups, but theoretically I can get it from LinkedIn groups. But the challenge then will be the exactly the sort of people that you need to attract to a digital event are the people who are already probably doing this stuff and self-organising it already on existing, not specifically conference, not specifically event, not specifically tech platforms like Twitter. Does that make sense? So you could, the very people who you most need to be able to be the ones who can set the norming behaviour in purely digital channels are the ones you're going to struggle most to be able to get to, because they'll look at it and they'll go, yeah, but it's full of people who don't know what they're doing. Why do I want to be there?
Mm. Yeah, that is a good point. It's a good point, and it's made me think a little bit about the things I used to do around social media and the FM world, and about communities, basically, about the fact that you are serving, when you're looking at buildings, take it very, very basically, you're serving various communities. If you've got a hospital, you're serving long-term communities and short-term communities and kind of medium-term communities. So your long-term communities are the people that work there. They're there every day. They're going to be there for quite a long time, and they are, you need to service those people in a different way as you service the short term. And the short term are people like visitors and outpatients and people that come there, and they're only there for a few hours. Then you have the medium term people who tend to be the inpatients, the people who are there for a period of time, but not, are only going to see a certain bit of the hospital, and they only need to know a certain amount. And this is all about the information you give them and the way you interact with them. So social media is good at that, because you can have short-term, long-term communities. Short-term around events, if you know what I mean. So a crash on the M1 or a delay on the M1 is an event. And if you're in a delay on the M1, then you're stuck in the car for an hour and not moving. If you search, you'll probably find that somebody near the front and knows what's going on, and you'll find that the news is on social media somewhere, and people are talking about it for a short period of time, and then the traffic moves again, and the community is gone. But it's a community for that length of time. Whereas other communities are, that they're kind of, maybe they're disciplinary communities in terms of you know, tech disciplines or legal or whatever it might be, and they are longer lasting, and they might be location based, you know, around a, you know, like your WhatsApp group for your road. So community, social media is there to support communities in the same way an event is there to support short and long-term communities as well, because you've got the vendors and the event people, and there are longer-term relationships, and they've got the people that turn up. So it's about how do you understand which communities are which and apply the right tech.
And the interesting thing out of that for me, the most useful thing that I've ever heard about talking about concepts of community, and this was from the stuff I did around collaboration research for Leading Edge Forum a few years back, I can't remember where it came from, but they talked about how, if you think about it as a community is best thought of where the members of the community have invested something of their own self-identity in them being a member of that community. So on my road, we all lived on Holmesdale Road, but actually in the last 3 months we have definitely created more of a sense of community because we've got to know each other. Because even though we all live next door to each other, it took WhatsApp during lockdown for us to start to know who each other are. And so now we have this wonderful sharing group that's, you know, looking for hints and tips. And when somebody's going to throw something out because they no longer need it, they're asking the group now if anybody else needs this thing, and And it's great. And it's established, even though the physical proximity part was already there and the timeliness thing was already there, but we used to come through our front doors and we didn't really talk to anybody other than our immediate next door neighbours. If you think about, I don't know, me as a Watford fan, that's another thing, an identity community thing where I've vested part of my identity in being a Watford fan, for good or for ill. But that very much is something that, and football fandom is very much about being part of a community where you very much invest a part of your, a profession is, again, you know, a doctor will have a sense of being part of the doctoring world or their specialism or whatever else. Interestingly, in IT, we don't have professionalism in that way. And there's, I think, a looser connection between IT as a profession as opposed to an individual pursuit. But within all of that, again, if you think about reframing it, because no longer is it about running events, if it's about actually how do we establish short, medium or long-term communities, then the question becomes not what platform do we shift our virtual event to, but it's about how do we establish people in a sense of community when we don't allow them to, we can't allow them to actually physically meet each other in such a way that they will invest a little bit of their self-identity in it. In the way that I have, definitely, Silicon Beach was an event I attended 6 or 7 times. There's a little bit of me that is a Silicon Beach person, or the names not numbers thing. There's a little bit of me, or IT Directors Forum. There's a teeny tiny bit of me, hello Liam, that is invested in that, where you and I first met, of course, Christopher. And that idea of how do you get people to give a bit of themselves for successful events, for successful communities, maybe that's another the challenge you've got ahead.
So, Matt, what is in store for you this week?
I'll probably be at my home office doing lots of Teams calls. Again, I know. Yeah, that is pretty much it, actually. I think looking ahead, the main thing will be, if the weather holds, is to go and see my mum and dad up in Suffolk. We were going to do it this weekend now that the regulations around travel and meeting up with people have been lessened a bit. But because I think it's best described, if it was pissing down all weekend.
It really was.
That it wasn't going to be a good idea, because standing outside in the cold and the rain with the North Sea wind whipping across you, as it has a tendency to do in bad weather in Suffolk, wasn't appealing. So hopefully the weather will be better this weekend and we'll be able to go and see them. But yeah, then Teams meetings interspersed with the occasional Zoom meetings, fair to middling. How about you?
Very similar. Lots of online meetings and jiggery pokery, and yeah, hopefully get to see my folks who are not so far away. But as you say, it was also persisting down with rain this week over here, so I'm hoping that it's going to be better and we can do that. So yeah, it should be a fun week, really. There's lots of good stuff to do, but it's very much like last week. I'm looking forward to a little bit of variety, you know, later in the year.
Yeah, you might be able to use blue jeans as well.
Thank you for listening. You can catch us, as always, on our website at wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at wb40podcast, or wherever you normally get your podcasts.